He says, just be content because I'm always going to be with you. Well, if I know this, that he, as my source, is never going to leave me, then it doesn't matter whether my resource shut down, the job, I got laid off, or the stock market dropped when I needed income, or, you know, CD rates are under 1%. These are resources. If I keep my eye on the source, I'll be okay.
From the Family Life Podcast Network, this is Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. This donor-supported podcast helps blended families and those that love them pursue the relationships that matter most. Welcome to episode number 58, Investing for Life After Kids. And by the way, if you haven't yet joined the movement, you can come with us. Just subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Just search Family Life Blended. You can also listen on YouTube and the new and improved Family Life app, which lets you take notes while you listen. Okay, we're going to get down into the weeds a little and talk about financial planning, retirement, and life when the kids are gone. My guest is Greg Pettis. Greg is a certified financial planner and consultant with over 35 years' experience in the financial services industry. He's worked with thousands of people, business owners, tax planning teams, and charitable trusts. Greg and I, along with David Edwards, co-authored the book, The Smart Step Family Guide to Financial Planning. Greg is an ordained pastor with a very unique ministry to those in prisons and people in the nation of India. He lives in Springfield, Illinois with Janita, his wife of 30 years, and has six children and a grandson. Now, Greg is not new to the Family Life Blended podcast. In episode number 19, Financing Togetherness in Blended Families, he and I and David Edwards talked in general about blended family relationships and things like money matters, debt issues, and merging your financial lives. I really want to recommend you listen to that podcast as well as this one. The two complement each other very nicely. Here's episode number 58 and my conversation with Greg Pettis. Greg, you and I have known each other quite a long time. What, 20 years ago we met? Something like that?
I think, yeah, right about that, 2001 or two, right in there.
Well, you're a financial planner and you help people strategize for life. Have you always liked numbers?
Yeah, I think numbers, but more importantly, concepts, I think. My mother was an artist and a musician, so I think I got some of that. And then my father was an accounting professor, a doctorate of accounting, and I got that. The numbers on one side and some creative thought and on the other, I kind of go back and forth. So I'm not all numbers. I like them, but I don't like to just focus on just numbers.
Okay, so I guess we're talking about the art of financial planning here today. Maybe that's what we're doing, pulling all of those influences in your life together. But let's be really clear with our listener right up front. We're not selling any products here. You're not here trying to make any money, right?
That's right, Ron. And it's important that our listeners hear this, that though I am licensed with FINRA and all the registered representative licenses, I'm not selling and I'm not actually functioning in my role as a registered rep today. It's just strictly educational. And it's important that our listeners know I'm not taking on clients at this time. I'm just an advisory role.
Right. That is important from a legal standpoint. But this stuff is real. I mean, we're not just talking theoretical. You and your wife, you're a blended family. You guys have had to do your own financial planning, right? I mean, the stuff we're talking about is not just theoretical. It's real for you and our listeners.
That's right. I'm a father of six blessed children from two different marriages, and so we are blended. And it's a process. Over these decades of listening and learning and planning. So more the art, I think, than the science.
Yeah, no, that's good. Okay, we're going to get into the how in a little bit here. We're going to get down to some logistics of investing for life after the kids. That's the title of this episode. But before we do that, quick question. Why is saving for later life so important? Philosophically speaking, why do people need to think about saving?
It's very likely that we'll spend a third of our lives without a paycheck. If a 65-year-old is retiring today, he has a life expectancy of in his mid-80s or longer, and females are living even longer than that. So having a third of your life where you don't get the paychecks and you're looking to other resources is so important to have a plan for that period of life. Both all the good things that will happen as well as maybe some potential risks.
Yeah, okay, so I think I just heard two comments in my head from listeners that I can imagine them saying. One of them is, but isn't Social Security going to take care of me? And you can address that one along with the other, which is, I just got depressed thinking about a third of my life without a paycheck. And I'm like thinking, now I've waited too long. So how would you respond to both of those things?
Well, the Social Security issue is approximately one-third or less of the average American's retirement income. And so we talk about a three-legged stool to have in retirement. That is company-sponsored retirement plans. Secondly, your own efforts in your retirement planning outside of your company. And the third leg of the stool is Social Security. So it's impossible to really stand on that, to have a comfortable retirement with just Social Security. But the good news is it's never too late to start.
Well, what do you mean by that?
And we talk about compounding interest. It's great to have a lot of time, but it's never too late to start. If you invested, you know, even $100 a month and you earned 6% compounded for 12 years, you'd have $20,000. Now, it would be better to go for 20 years and you would be, you know, closer to $50,000 compounded. But it's never too late to get started in some plans. You can make a big impact for you and your family even today if it was just a starting time.
Okay, good. Let's come back to compound interest and strategies for actually doing investing here in just a minute. But I want us to push pause on this conversation, Greg. And let's just start off with some biblical perspectives about money. Here's a question. Retirement is not used anywhere in the Bible. That's a modern day concept. The idea of being able to save to the point where you can kind of quit your job, your career, and rest. I hear people talking about refirement, not retiring, but refiring and moving on to something else. Like we're all called into lots of things in life that have nothing to do with earning money. So it's not like we just stop living. But what do you think about this question? Is retirement even a, quote, biblical concept?
I think if it's in the context of stewarding your life, as your life is a stewardship of your time, resources, your energy, your gifting, then retirement, to me, is a godly thing. But on the other hand, what we don't mean is just quitting and not being productive in some kind of an endeavor. I think if everything had worked out in the garden, Adam would have enjoyed gardening his entire life because it's about productivity. It's about fruitfulness. So I agree with refirement. Personally, I never want to just quit. I love what I do. And in every aspect, there's always going to be another chapter, right?
Exactly.
And those golden years should be golden, not just because of the cash you've got or the golden stock, but it should be golden because you're wiser than you've ever been.
And perhaps golden in part because of what you're doing for others with some of that you've saved. And stewardship. I really like that. I think the thing when people react to the word retire, say it's not biblical. I think what they're saying is, if that word really means I'm now resting in what I've accomplished, I'm now just going to sit back and enjoy the fruits of my labor, and I don't have to do anything for anybody anymore. Like, my giving is over.
Yeah.
Now that, I agree. That is not the attitude to have as we think about retirement.
That sounds more like the rich young ruler. You know, that was told, look, your possessions have you instead of you having them. And you could tell it in his language, my barns, and I will pull down my barns, and I will build bigger for my wealth. But on the other hand, you see Solomon and David and some of the old patriarchs fruitful. They became more wise and more fruitful all through their long, long lives. I think it should be an increase in productivity, even if it's less physical energy that's being put out. I think more spiritual and mental can come with age, I hope.
Right. You might not be receiving financial gain from what we're putting out at that season of our life. But again, that's okay, because we're still giving and stewarding what God has given us. Just to create some perspective for the rest of this episode, so we're thinking rightly about money and its place in our lives, let me just read some scriptures, and I'd love to react around them with you just real quickly. 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10. This is with the New Living Translation. Listen to this. Yet true godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came into the world, and we can't take anything with us when we leave it. So if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. But people who long to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith and pierced themselves with many sorrows. I'm hearing themes there, Greg. Contentment, people who long to be rich, the love of money leads us away from true faith. What are your thoughts?
I think it's about the heart, don't you, Ron? It's like the heart is the determining factor whether that $100 bill that we just placed in the offering plate for a mission trip, it was amoral. The actual $100 bill is not either good or bad. In fact, it had traces of cocaine from a drug deal yesterday. But it's going into the plate today to fund mission work for God's kingdom. So, you know, as Timothy continues, charge those who are rich in this world that they don't be conceited, don't get high-minded, and trust in your uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us all things richly to enjoy. But yet, don't love the money, but it's okay to know that if it was from the Father, He wants us to enjoy what it can do for us, but don't love it.
So don't love it and don't trust it. Yeah. Love God, trust God, and enjoy what He gives us and be content with what He gives
There's
us.
There's a key. I think that is the key, don't you? The contentment.
Absolutely. Because it's the love of money, not money itself. It's the love of money that's very clear here, that that is the root of all kinds of evil. It's when it becomes the thing we trust satisfy our hearts and bring us what we want. Let's do another one. Proverbs 21:20. You mentioned Solomon a little while ago. Proverbs 21:20. The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get. This is a great one for parents, you know?
I wish I had known this one earlier.
The fool spends whatever he gets. Are you going to be a fool? Are you going to be wise?
You know what? In any family, there's usually a spender by nature and a saver. And quite frankly, I think I might be a spender more than a saver, quite frankly.
Is that right?
It's been good to have Johnita helping me with our own household. Because it is clear that saving and investing is biblical. It is. When Jesus talked about the parable of talents, he said to the one, the guy that hid his talent, "You fool! You should have at least taken it to the bank.
Done something with it.
Yeah. Done something with it and received some interest on the money. But the fool is thinking about today, only what's in it for today." That's a good one. That's convicting there.
By the way, when you read Proverbs, there's usually a contrast. There's an opening statement and a secondary statement, and it's not just what those statements say. It's the contrast between them that helps to to flesh out the full meaning of the proverb. So here we have wise are investing, and they have wealth, they have luxury, they have things because of how they handle their resources. But fools just spend, spend, spend. They're looking for the quick fix. They're looking for the immediate gratification. And it's the gap between those two things where I think the real lesson is. Like, we have the moments of decision where we can go in one direction or the other. Don't be a fool. Understand what money is for rather than making it your God. Just use it for the things that are wise in this world. Let's do one more, and then we'll jump into investing for life after the kids. Hebrews 13, 4 through 6. Keep your life free from the love of money. Again, love of money. There it is. Keep your life free from the love of money and be content. There it is again. With what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?
Well, as long as you know he's with you and you know he's your source, then it doesn't matter what happens to the resource, the job. Your resource might shut down. As long as you know, see, he says, just be content because I'm always going to be with you. Well, if I know this, that he, as my source, is never going to leave me, then it doesn't matter whether my resource shut down, the job, I got laid off, or the stock market dropped when I needed income, or, you know, CD rates are under 1%. These are resources. If I keep my eye on the source, I'll be okay.
God is my provider, not my 401k. Let's just hold those perspectives as we now talk about some of the details of investing and thinking about where do couples need to start? I think most of them need to start. We wrote a book together, by the way, you and I and David Edwards, the Smart Step Family Guide to Financial Planning. We talk about the importance of sitting down as you're starting this process and creating what David calls an own and owe list. Get in touch with what you have, your assets and your liabilities, and write them down. Why is that a good place to start?
Well, in any, let's say we're looking at this as a journey, which indeed it is. The financial planning is a journey. You know, it might be good that we know where we're going. That's very important. But then, before we embark, we have to know where we are and what we've got in order to take this journey. So taking a financial inventory, as our co-author, attorney Dave Edwards, said so well in his 10 Tips to Get Started list, he said, number one, make that list. Oh, what do I owe and what do I own? And not only what do I owe and what do I own, but who is on the title? Who owns? And not just who, but how does the person own? And who's going to be the beneficiary? Those are key. I'd say three keys to the inventory.
Okay, so let me ask you to define something, because I'm going to play the novice in this conversation, and that's going to be really easy because I am one. All right. So I get to represent all the people listening going, what did he just say? I don't understand a word. When you say, how do you own something? What do you mean by that?
Well, in single name or in joint name or as a corporation or as an individual or a trust or as other entities like partnerships and so forth.
Okay, so let's just jump in, because we had somebody on Facebook ask, all right, so we have a house, or I have a house, and that's got my name on it, that preceded our blended family marriage. Do we put my husband's name on the house? Do we try to redo that? Let's talk around that for a minute, because joint tenants, just because you're living in the house doesn't mean you both own it, right?
That is true, and every situation, as I would repeat this a lot today, is every situation is going to be customized. It needs to be individually looked at. No two scenarios are going to be exactly the same. But when we talk about owning a home together, is that what you were approaching?
Yes.
So yeah, there's often confusion about how the joint ownership can work. Basically, there are two most commonly used titlings for joint ownership. One is called joint tenants with the rights of survivorship. We use acronyms a lot in our business, so we call that JTWROS, joint tenants with rights of survivorship. And the other one is JTIC, J-T-I-C, joint tenants in common.
What's the difference?
Well, there are similarities because the couple, both couples own a home together. However, the real difference is what happens to the home when one of the spouses dies. With joint tenants with rights of survivorship, the interest of the decedent passes 100% to the surviving spouse automatically. Mm. Nothing has to be done. No paperwork has to be filled out. It was owned joint tenants with rights of survivorship, and now it belongs to the surviving spouse 100% automatically. Nothing has to be done. With joint tenants in common, which is a popular form of ownership with remarried couples, is a deceased spouse's interest does not automatically go 100% to the surviving spouse, but their percentage, so there can be a various percentages, goes into their estate to be distributed as their will says, or by a trust. So it could be 90-10, 80-20, 60-40. My 60 would go to my children from a previous marriage, for example. This is one reason people would use JTIC. And your 40% would go to your parents or your siblings.
And so you can change the how you own the house together. Let's just run a scenario. So Nan and I are married, and we bought a house 3 years ago, which we did. And we both signed on the dotted line, and we got a mortgage, and we bought this house together. And, you know, I don't remember anywhere in the discussion of signing the 8,000 pieces of paper that you have to sign.
Exactly.
Any conversation around either rights of survivorship or tenants in common. Is there a typical default? Is it typically rights of survivorship?
That's a great question, and I can hear my attorney friends reminding me that it depends. Oh, don't you hate when people say that? It depends on what state you are in.
Huh.
Because
okay,
there are about 9 states in our union that have common law laws, and they are completely different than the other, 41 states.
Interesting.
And so my state might default to joint tenants with rights of survivorship. Another state might say no. And usually if it's JTIC, they'll ask what percentages. So that's a good giveaway if you're filling out a document. Yeah.
They would have to ask that up front. So let's assume it's rights of survivorship. Mm-hmm. Let's assume, Lord willing, this doesn't happen. I die. And my wife, Nan, gets the house.
Yes.
Time goes on. She meets somebody else. She falls in love and decides to get married. The house is hers.
That's right.
It's only got her name on it. He's now living there. They're living there. Kids, family, whatever. Everybody's involved in that. He doesn't own any of it, right?
He doesn't. However, depending on what state you're living in, there are laws that allow that second husband some rights to estates that aren't clearly titled. There are old laws called dowry and curtsy, where one surviving spouse has certain rights to make claim. They can get really chaotic and negative with contesting, you know, the intention of a spouse. Children and stepchildren, they deserve the right to have a clear, you know, understanding in writing would be great, not just verbal, but everyone who can be informed. That's a gift we can give them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it occurs to me to, again, recommend to our listener the other podcast that you've been involved in, also with David Edwards, that was based on our book, and that is episode number 19, Financing Togetherness in Blended Families. One of the things we talk about extensively there that we won't spend a lot of time on here is just this idea of creating a togetherness agreement that would allow you to actually become aware before somebody dies and you go, oops, we walked into something we didn't intend. You get to become aware of what's on the paperwork and how you own that house and decide how you want to extend that to a new spouse or new stepchildren or what have you.
And Ron, what I love about the togetherness agreement is not just the what and the who, but the why. So I get to explain to my heirs why I didn't give this business to my all six of my children. Why did so-and-so get this? What was I thinking when I decided to put part of my father's inheritance in a trust for charity? Was it because, you know, the motives and the feelings behind money are often such the power to make things good or bad, huh?
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's a big portion of the book that we wrote to help people understand how what we say, we call it below the surface issues, the emotions, the value that you put behind why you gave somebody the house or didn't give somebody the house. Right. It allows you, when you're able to say to them out loud, look, I didn't give you 1/6 of the business because I know you don't like the business and because this is a better provision for you. This is what I did do for you. Well, then it's like, okay, I can see Dad's love and heart and how he values me, and that's what's most important. But at the end of the day, people got to understand whether they got tenants' rights of survivorship or tenants in common, and it is an important distinction to be aware of.
It is. And, you know, as I advise and consult on cases throughout the Midwest, I talk with attorneys, and I bring up our Chapter 2, the Togetherness Agreement. I was with a very well-known attorney in Missouri, and she said, I do a lot of prenuptial agreements. And I said, would you look at Chapter 2? She said, what's this? I said, we took the prenup, turned it upside down, and shook the animosity out of it. And instead of saying things like, here, sign this. Well, what's that? That says that you're not going to get my business one day. That says that you're not going to get that stock account my dad left me. It says this. No, you're not going to get the business because I had promised that to my two children from a previous marriage in writing. I had already had that worked out in a buy-sell agreement. But what I am doing for you, you know, is putting $1 million of life insurance in a trust. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get everything you need. And no, I can't give you the stock account. I inherited that from my father. It's going to stay in the family. But what we will do is open up a Q-tip or something like that, a qualified terminable interest property trust. I'll drop some CDs in there, and at my demise, you'll live off of that money from the trust for your health and education, the maintenance of your standard of living. When you pass, it doesn't go to your children. It comes back to mine or to my charity, whoever I name as the Q-tip beneficiary.
Yes, yes. And so all of a sudden, you're conveying value, you're communicating the importance of people in your life, and then demonstrating how you're going to care for them through making these decisions. I want to shift a little bit. I feel like on our way to talking a little bit more about retirement and the different options that people have there to save, we need to talk a little bit about college education for kids, because a lot of people are, you know, mindful of that too. We're not just saving for us, we're saving for them one day. If the kids are young, how do we get there? you've got a couple of strategies that you recommend. Let's just high level hit these things. Education funding strategy number one, listen to each child and determine the best way to support their educational needs. What do you mean by that?
Not all our children really are cut out or want a four-year traditional liberal arts education. And I use my six as an example without naming the names. Four of them have gone through college. One of them, a two-year program, which was phenomenal. That child was so gifted with the whole gemology arena that instead of a four-year degree, they said, no, I'm just going to go get a designation. And I say just, it was a fantastic organization out in California, gave her the very top education in gemology. Well, she's risen to the top of her industry. She's doing phenomenal with estate jewelry and grading of diamonds. And, you know, so the four-year route wasn't for her. On the other hand, and one of my children became a Navy pilot, was blessed to, you know, be given a scholarship to the U.S. Naval Academy. So that's way out on an edge where, you know, I think 0.5% of our children get that. What a blessing. One of my children is a special needs son, gifted in so many other ways, tremendous guy, and he didn't need a four-year degree. You know, and we go on and on. So I think in the first part of our chapter on educating and funding of education, we talk about listening, watching, taking notes. What are their hobbies? What are their interests? You know, the whole ACT, SAT score arena is changing, both the tests and the way colleges look at them. But having some understanding of the FAFSA,
yeah,
that free application for federal student aid, is important too.
Yeah, that's the second thing that you say parents, and especially in blended families, need to take a look at. And we've talked about this before, but I think just in brief, it's important to let people know FAFSA determines the ability for you or your child to get a loan for college, based not on who has custody of the child, based not on whose income is the highest between the two households, but on who actually has the child physically in their home the more days than the other home in any given year, or the year preceding them going to college. Did I get that right?
That's right. The year preceding the year that you are... Uh-huh. So if this October, this last October of 2020... when we applied for our son's FAFSA to find out our EFC, expected family contribution, we used 19's tax records in October of 2020 to determine 21 scholarships and grants. Yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize, like you said, it's calendar days of custody that determine which couple's finances are going to be used on the FAFSA. And my second spouse, my remarried spouse, even if I had signed a prenuptial agreement, or in our case, we call the togetherness agreement, even they've said, I'm not going to participate because you signed this document, they still have to use their finances on the FAFSA. So, you know, the U.S. Department of Education doesn't care about the legal ramifications of your prenup. They're going to count both incomes. So if I'm a child and my biological father is a hardworking blue-collar worker and he's remarried someone earning a modest income, let's say together they're earning $60,000, but my biological mother is a surgeon and she's remarried a rocket scientist, and they're making $1 million a year. If I could just have the two couples be aware of this and chat a little bit about that extra week in the summer where the child stays with dad, and let's say 186 days of the year in a joint custody arrangement, and only 181, or let's see, maybe less than that, 179 with mom, then my dad fills out my FAFSA. There's assets that are not counted when we're filling out a FAFSA. Those are important to know. We list those in our book, that they, you can actually legally shelter money in these assets that are not counted on a FAFSA form for determining EFC, expected family contribution.
Let's turn the corner and talk about retirement. Now, in real life, these things are never disconnected. We kind of talk about them as if they are, but in real life, the saving for college is also wrapped into the strategy, thinking about long-term investment and so on. But let's just hit a few principles that could be helpful for people who are trying to think about the future and providing for their family. Retirement strategy number one, time in the market versus timing the markets. Can you give us a little tutorial on that?
Well, a study done by a major brokerage firm here in America from the beginning of this century till now, so let's call it 20 years, They actually did the study and determined if I was on the sidelines, in other words, I felt the market was at a high, it was going to drop, and I sold out, and I was in cash out of the market, the S&P 500, on the 10 best days in the 20-year period, my total return would be half what it would have been had I stayed in the market and weathered out all the valleys. Then in trying to guess when the market's high and get out, or when it's low and buy low and try to trade, then you're going to lose the opportunities that you would have had, because you're inevitably going to make mistakes. No one can predict the best days. So that's what we mean there, is that buy quality investments that are suitable for your goals and your time horizon and your risk profile, and hold those quality investments for the whole term, and you'll do a lot better than if you were trying to trade in and out and market timing.
Diversification. What is that about?
Well, we've heard the old adage, you know, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. So it's actually putting your investments in different asset classes, stocks, bonds, cash, real estate, metals, etc., because each one of these are going to perform differently in any economic scenario. I use the analogy of, hey, if I owned a shop, a retail shop on the beach down in Sarasota, I'd probably, no doubt, carry suntan lotion, t-shirts, and umbrellas. But it would be a wise thing to have some sweatshirts over on the corner, nice thick sweatshirts, because who knows, there in, you know, January, February in Sarasota, if I might decide I need a sweatshirt, it sits down in the 60s. So whatever the economic temperature will make the demand on certain assets different than the other asset. I think in terms of investing as having different animals, if I were to put a dog, a cat, a turtle, and a goldfish in a goldfish bowl in my living room and turn the heat up, so if I turn the economic heat up, inflation or interest rates go up, the cat will start running around the room, tearing things up. The dog will fall asleep. The turtle will just keep on crawling, won't even care, and the fish won't know it happened.
Yeah.
The fish inside that aquarium. So in any economic environment, having stocks, bonds, you know, cash, metals, real estate in different proportions to your based upon your discussions with your financial planner is a wise thing.
So diversify what you invest in. Keep the money there. That's time in the markets. And then the third strategy,
exactly,
tax-free investment vehicles. Now, this is where I get confused. You know, let's talk about an IRA. There's a Roth IRA. Man, can you just give us the basics on the differences there?
Well, yes. The the individual retirement account is one where you place money in this account and receive a deduction. And then when it's time to take your distribution for retirement, you will be taxed as ordinary income in your current brackets. However, the Roth IRA, on the other hand, you do not get the deduction when you make your deposit. But the power of a Roth is that no matter how large the account grew, when you take your distribution, it's tax-free. All of your investment is immediately tax-free, of course, and then the earnings on your account have a tax ramification that depends on how long you had the account open and how old you are when you take the distribution. But the Roth IRA, with limits up to $6,000 and an extra $1,000 and $7,000 if you're 50 or older, is a really interesting starting point, I would say, for most people here listening to talk to their advisors about as an opportunity for tax-free retirement income.
As I hear you say that, what's echoing in my head is what you said earlier about everybody has a different plan potentially. And there are some things that will fit a lot of people, but not everyone everywhere. So sitting down with somebody who help you put all these different strategies together into something coherent for your situation, the amount of time that you have to invest, and how much risk you're willing to take, that's really what a financial planner does. Do you have to pay a financial planner for their time, or do they somehow win when you win from an investment standpoint?
Good questions. We cover that question in our chapter on retirement. We start out with credentials and, let's say, roles of your team. Not every advisor is, well, coming from the same background, experience, knowledge, designation. Some are truly just product salespeople, and you got to watch out. You got to watch that. Others that have spent time in specialties like CFP, Certified Financial Planner, or CHFC, Chartered Financial Consultant, and of course your CPA, Certified Public Accountant, and your attorneys with legal degrees. The answer is not every advisor is coming from the same place with same experience and knowledge, and therefore they will not all conduct their businesses the same way as far as remuneration. Some will be commission only, some will be fee only, and some will be a mix of commissions and fee. And it's always good to interview more than one advisor, get referrals from people that you know and you trust their advice, that they've had a good experience, and then sit down and ask those questions and get it in writing. Mm-hmm. What are your fees? What are the fee schedules? How are you paid?
And one of the things you and I have discovered in the course of writing this book is that financial planners are benefiting from our book as well, because they understand the money aspects, but they don't always necessarily understand the relational dynamics going on within blended families. So share it with them, ask them to read a couple of those chapters and raise their awareness about some of the things your family is trying to navigate. And then together, I think you can end up in a better place.
Exactly. And a good place to refer your financial advisory team is to the website of our co-author, attorney David Edwards, blendedfamilyfinances.com. Mm-hmm. It's a great place. He's got some 10 tips to get started to avoid money drama. And he also does some very objective coaching for people that want another pair of eyes from an attorney.
Greg, I've got a couple of estate planning questions for you. Let's have this question in the back of our minds. Somebody on Facebook said this Should I have a trust set up for my kids? They're under 25 years of age. His kids are adults. And then she says, I'm replacing my will. He doesn't have a will. Okay? So with that in mind, as you think about gathering the documents, any couple listening, you've been married 10 years right now, or maybe you're just about to get married, you're on the front end of this thing, whatever your situation is as a blended family, thinking about long-term estate, how's that going to roll to the next generation? There's matters of wills and trusts and power of attorney for finances and for healthcare and living wills and healthcare directives. Those are all things that are kind of in the hopper with all of this. And this lady's saying, all right, I've got a will. He doesn't have a will. Do I need a trust set up for my kids? How would you respond?
Again, and I hate to be vague about this, but, you know, there is no cookie cutter financial plan.
No, it's important to say, and now, I know that it's not dodging the question, because what you're saying is people need to stop and look and think about the whole picture, not just because it's
right,
not just
Trump.
About a trust. It's about life insurance, and it's about whose name's on the house, and like all of that goes into consideration together, right?
Well, it's like, you know, that's right. When you share with us how that remarriage is like everyone having baggage and holding on to a series of ropes together, you know, the tension and that, it's even more real in the financial world. Those bags are filled with finances. And when I tug over here, it affects my inheritance. And I tug over here, it takes away from my retirement. And what my ex does with her finances does impact my children. And so we're all pushing and pulling. My default answer, Ron, this is my opinion after 35 years of dealing with hundreds of cases, is to default to having a will. Because if you don't have one and you've left something out of your trust, you'll need what's called a pour-over will that says, hey, I put everything I think into my trust, but in case I didn't, this document pours it over into my trust. So even people that have trusts might find that they also have to have some type of a will, a derivative. But having a will, if we don't have one in a modest, simple estate, then the state you live in has a will for you. It's called dying intestate, and you will go through intestate succession. For example, if I'm a single guy, 25 years of age, and I die in my state, half of my belongings go back up the ladder to my parents.
You're saying it in the state of Illinois, where you live, if you die at 25 years, half of all your possessions go up.
Go back up to your parents. Is that really what I wanted? I don't know. Maybe. But my point is then they come back down the ladder to my siblings eventually. So if I had a will and I wanted, my intentions were that my brother and my sister get something, I name them in my will and that goes right to them through the process of probate instead of going up the family tree to my parents and then coming back down one day to my siblings when they're 20 years older.
What I hear you saying is, do you want the state that you live in dictating what happens to your stuff, or do you want to dictate what happens to your stuff?
That's it. And so it doesn't have to be complex, but many people should also go that step further. And I think her focus on a trust for children that are under 25 is a good idea to take to the attorney. Make sure you carry the big picture of your legacy plan. Why is it that you want this trust? Sometimes one of our children is a spendthrift. Other times there's the threat of an unstable relationship they're entering into. There's the curve that life throws of credit problems. Some children may have addictions. There may be special needs, gifted children, and as in my case. So having a trust is a great second step with your attorney.
I think, Greg, you just wandered into that area of what's fair. When it comes to estate planning, and you think about your children and their situations and how you provide for them, what their needs are, what they can do for themselves, there's a lot to consider. And this issue of fair, I find, is very, there's a hypersensitivity to this across the board, but especially in blended family marriages. Why? Because it's rooted in the concern that, you know, my spouse doesn't seem to care as much as for my kids as I care for my kids. And so the fact that you want to, you know, give some of your assets to your children, but not to my children, reinforces that idea that you really don't love my kids. And so I'm bitter when you say you don't want to, you're going to do it this way and not that way. And I think what people end up doing is ascribing negativity where it doesn't necessarily belong. We like to talk about being equitable in providing for the next generation. Doesn't necessarily always mean it's fair, right?
That is a great concept that you've brought to the table. I never had used the equitable word until you started talking about it, Ron. That's so powerful because, look, for let's say a family like mine with a special needs child, you really should not leave one-third, one-sixth, whatever, how many children you have, to the special needs child outright. You could very well disqualify them from federal Social Security, the state benefits that you're in, et cetera, et cetera. You could be, well, working against their best interest. So in one case, I leave the business to the two boys that have worked it for their 20 years.
Because they're invested and they're involved and they understand
my daughters, yeah. My daughters from my current marriage, they're not interested. They love, you know, fashion design in Chicago. They don't want to work with my lumber yard.
Yeah.
Down in, you know, little town USA.
This is so important, Greg. I mean, again, there's two things working here. There's the developmental considerations for your children and their life and their preferences, their passions. You know, when your children are young at Christmas, you buy your 10-year-old one kind of gift and your 6-year-old a different kind of gift, and they both got gifts, but the dollar amount that you paid on both of those could be vastly different. That's still equitable. It's still appropriate for them given their age, their interests, et cetera. Fast forward that into later life, and it's the same type of principle involved here. But again, when people start saying, that's not fair, and really what they're saying is, you don't care. But when somebody begins to insert meaning that is not necessarily fitting, now we have a problem. So when somebody says, that's not fair, that equals you don't care about me, my child, our family, what have you. Well, now you may have had it something that was equitable, but you destroy it by loading in a bunch of negativity on top of it around the word fair. I want to encourage our listeners to really be careful about that, to examine their own heart. If you feel like something is a fair issue, what is it that's really bothering you about it? I'm not saying it might be inequitable and unfair, but is it really about your concern and the relationship concerns going on between step family members? If that's what it's really about, then deal with that. Deal with that. Let financial planners help you find a creative strategy in estate planning for, you know, stewarding your assets to the next generation, but don't spoil it with the fair issue that's not really an issue.
May I share an above the ground, above surface idea? The great equalizer, okay? So I deal with a lot of farmers in the Midwest. One child is in the 1,000-acre farm, loves it. Two children are not interested in inheriting dad's farm. They really never have liked getting dirt in their fingernails, and they don't want a part of that. Well, other assets can be used for an equitable inheritance, but I find life insurance can be one of the great equalizers. It is so leverageable, pennies and nickels into dollars, and you can make it a custom work where an exact dollar figure makes up the difference in one child's inheritance. You know, and whereas a child wouldn't want the farm, having X dollars in a nice trust that they can spend or use as income for the rest of their lives could be a nice solution.
And to
for
our
that.
Listener, when you hear the word farm, you can think of your family business. It could be anything. That's a 401k.
Exactly.
It's whatever that asset is, and dividing it up. Yeah, maybe it goes one way more than another way, but you provide life insurance for those other two kids, and you know maybe it, can it also be an equalizer for your spouse? Like, you know, you put the family business in a trust to your children, but life insurance to provide for your spouse. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And you know, over half of the cases I work with are people over 65. And it's never too late. I just want to say that again. It's never too late to take that trip to the attorney, to talk about your goals, your vision, how you feel, bring it all out, and have a plan designed for where you are right now and where you're headed.
That's a good word. It's a good encouragement. Greg, as we wrap up here, I just want to return to that passage that we read at the beginning. Hebrews 13, 4 to 6. Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I just want to emphasize this so much. For he has said, this is a promise from the Lord for those that are in the palm of his hand. I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the author of Hebrews says, we can confidently say based on that, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? What can the market do to me? What can my 401k manager do to me? My trust is in the Lord. He is my provider. And if that's where my heart is and my head is, we're going to try to be good stewards with what God has given us. We're going to try to be wise about that. But at the end of the day, we walk and we trust in him. You've been listening to my conversation with Greg Pettis. I'm Ron Deal, and this is Family Life Blended. You know, I've got one more comment about that Hebrews 13 passage. I know a businessman who, around tax season, consulted with his financial planner and bookkeeper, and they advised him to sink a pretty sizable lump sum of money into retirement. Well, he decided to invest most of that money, but while reflecting on Hebrews 13, 4-6, he also decided to make a donation to a ministry that he believed in because he wanted to do something tangibly to make himself trust the Lord. You know, being content is a state of mind, and it's fueled in part by our trust that God will never leave us. If it's up to me to provide for myself, I'm going to hold on to every dollar. But if it's not up to me, I'm going to share a portion of what I have with others and wisely steward the rest. Trusting God, in part, means putting our money where our mouth is. You know, sometimes our listeners find themselves in a position where they want to help someone else. I want you to know about an opportunity. Each fall at Family Life, we put on the Summit on Step Family Ministry. It's an equipping conference that helps pastors and lay couples alike understand more about step family living and what your church can do to impact others. We'd love to have you join us and learn how to help others. Visit summitonstepfamilies.com for all the information you need. That's summitonstepfamilies.com. If you'd like more information about my guest, you'll find it in our show notes, or you can check it out on the Family Life Blended podcast page. That's at familylife.com/blended podcast. And while you're there, check out everything else Family Life has for your marriage and family. Our division, Family Life Blended, has the world's largest collection of articles, videos, resources, and books for blended families, like the book, The Smart Step Family Guide to Financial Planning, and my new book for engaged couples and premarital counselors called Preparing to Blend. That book comes out in September 2021. By the way, you can also on our website learn about local and virtual events that you can be a part of. Check us out. The show notes will tell you how. You know, we really love it when people review the podcast or leave a comment. Kiza shared on Facebook, great advice and parenting tips for blended families. Well, glad you think so. Thanks for that feedback. You too can leave a rating or a review and share this episode with somebody. We all need a little encouragement from time to time, so think of a couple of friends or family members that you could share this podcast with, or maybe post something on social media. One little share could make a big difference for someone else. Next time, we'll hear from Jed and Jenny Jurchenko about conversations your blended family can have that will strengthen your home, like how you deal with things that make you feel shame.
What my brain heard at the time was, God hates divorce. You're moving in that direction. God hates you.
That's Jed and Jenny Jurchenko, next time on Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our Family Life Legacy partners for making this podcast possible. If you want to join them, you can help us produce this podcast and other resources by making a tax-deductible donation specifically for Family Life Blended by going to familylife.com/blendedpodcast and clicking the donate button, or just look in the show notes for a link. Our chief audio engineer is Keith Lynch, Bruce Goff, our producer, mastering engineer is Justin Adams, project coordinator Ann Ancaro, and theme music provided by Braden Deal. Family Life Blended is produced by Family Life and is part of the Family Life Podcast Network.